with the latest in technology news and views. This is TechWrap, the podcast.
This is TechWrap, the podcast. We're online at techwrap.net. You can email us as well, mail@techwrap.net. Hello, William.
Mr. Geddes, how are you this week? Another week of tech, another week of lockdown for me, week of freedom for you. How has it been for you? Has it been a kind one full of blue skies and sunshine, or misery and storm clouds?
Things are a lot better. Let's not be misery and be down about the situation. There's a green sky. There's a blue sky. There's green grass.
This is me singing earlier about green trees and green trees and green grass and blue skies, and I got into your brain.
Just a little bit. Look, things are going to be a lot better than they are currently for some of us. It's just one of those things. We've never encountered it before. We'll get through it. And there's been a lot going on in technology.
Yeah, do you remember last week on the podcast, right at the end of our quick headlines, we were talking about Elon Musk's live stream about Neuralink?
I do and remember.
I was like,
you.
Are you watching? Are you going to watch? Are you going to set your alarm clock? Because I think it was something silly for us in Australia. It was 3 a.m. in the morning or something. Mm. I didn't watch it live.
Well, I missed it completely.
It's not something you're going to set your alarm to unless you're, maybe a biohacker and you're really into implanting things like in your arm and growing ears on you and things in your bits and pieces, you know what I mean? Mm. But it was interesting, and it's not something I saw coming. And then when I saw the news the following day after it, it was just a giant image of a pig being fed like a baby bottle or something. And essentially what had happened, he demonstrated that his Neuralink chip had been implanted in a pig's brain for 2 months and the pig's fine. So they're like, check out the Neuralink pig. And then they brought it out. I think the pig's name was Gertrude,
yes.
Something like that. So apparently it's recording signals from the pig's brain linked to her snout. And, I mean, it's not really great because, you bring out a pig and then it's not like you can – it doesn't do any amazing tricks. It doesn't levitate. It doesn't fly. It can't do my maths homework. Like, what's the point of this pig? But I guess the point is that, they did it and it's in it and it's alive. We didn't kill the pig. I want to know how many pigs they killed prior to wheeling this one out, trying to get this chip in the brain. But I guess – I mean, it's a step forward, right? Like today, pigs; tomorrow, humans.
Well, yes, there's avenues for that in the future. Potentially, you do have to wonder about what they've been working on behind the scenes, how many have been involved. Bit of an underwhelming launch, I'd suggest.
Although, very disappointing for me.
Although the Electric Jesus has his fan base, and I'm sure there's enough Electric Jesus supporters that would have woo-hooed at what went on regardless.
Yeah, I guess the goal of it is to, one of the many features that they're hoping to come from this is to restore motor function in people who maybe have paralysis or spinal cord injuries, could, fire signals in the brain to activate their limbs, maybe control prosthetic limbs, or I guess then if at the point where your brain's controlling devices to help you move and get about the place, I guess the next sort of leap on for that is using your brain to control your iPhone, set my alarm using my brain. I don't actually have to pick it up. I can just think about setting my alarm for 8 a.m. No, that's too early. I can set about thinking and setting an alarm for 9 a.m. right, and then it will automatically set the alarm on my phone without me having to pick it up. Now, that's probably the most boring use case that
neat
I've picked
feature.
Out for having a chip in your brain. Maybe I could launch, missiles just by thinking about it, and I just got to think about the access code. But then you forget about the access code, and you're like, shit, I forgot. Was it 319874?
Boom!
Oh, no, and then you think about another access code, and it fires off another missile that wasn't meant to go off, and it's nothing but disaster. I see nothing but disaster for this chip.
I do too. I worry about where we're going when we're talking about
implanting. Oh, I can turn all the lights off in my house. You know, when you go to bed and then you're like, oh, shit, I forgot to turn the bathroom light off. And then you got to get up out of bed,
get this thing in,
turn the light off. I can now just think about turning the light off, and then the light goes off. This is genius. I'm back on board. I'm all for the chip. I'll be first in line.
You know what? For turning lights on and off, nothing beats the old smart speaker, Google
Alexa.
Home, Alexa.
Google, turn my bathroom light off.
Google Home. I've got
one. Do you use that?
It's just not. It's not being used currently because I've got a little bit of an in situ thing going on at the moment. I don't have my bedroom because there's some renovations going on. So this would always sit on the bedside table. It was my speaker for streaming music, radio stations, turning the lights on and off. And also, of course, you could set your daily activities as well. So you could wake up to an alarm through this thing and you know, get it to read you out, you know, news items and whatnot. That was really functional.
Yeah, but how do you activate it? You have to use your voice, right?
Yes,
your vocal cords.
Have to use your voice. So if you didn't have your voice, that could be a problem.
Technology. Primitive. You might as well be lighting campfires and eating raw meat. This chip, you just think about it and you're there. Forget vocal cords.
Well, there's potential for that, but it's a bit underdeveloped at the moment.
I just had a brainwave. If I had the Neuralink and you had the Neuralink, could we communicate via Wi-Fi, otherwise known as telepathy, without talking? Like, I could just hook straight into your Neuralink and we could communicate secretly.
That'd be delightful, wouldn't it? We wouldn't have any content like this.
Everyone would just be sitting around like this, just like with their eyes closed and doing all their work like this. Can't be good for your posture. Oh, but you could light it. You know, this is the future. Just sitting here, eyes closed, and all that's going on up here.
You know what?
Let's not talk about this anymore. This is very grim and dark.
You know what?
This is like an episode of Black Mirror.
It can't be good for your brain either. You can't ever switch off.
All right. Unless you turn the Neuralink off and it shuts your whole brain off.
Can you do that though? Who knows?
Oh, God knows. Tell me some better news. Tell me something more enlightening. Something a bit more happy. It always ends up in a dark place, this future.
Enlightening.
Maybe it's just me.
Maybe we could go to one of the biggest tech events that's been happening in the last week or so. Good old IFA. 2020 occurred over in Berlin. You know, interesting, a lot different to how it has been given the fact that COVID got in the way. But, of course, COVID gave IFA the opportunity to start looking at gadgets that people can use with their post-COVID lifestyle. So things like LG and their wearable air purifying device, in other words, a mask.
Oh, when I thought you meant wearable air purifying device, I thought you meant it's something that connects to your body. And then if you're emitting like a bad body odor, it like automatically releases, like, you know, those things you plug into the wall that every so often they release the air freshener into the air. I thought it was something like that, but you wear it. So maybe you walk, you're in the office, right? And you're walking past all the cubicles and you accidentally let, you know, something out that you don't want people to smell, but luckily you're wearing the new wearable and it emits like a nice rosy mist that follows you instead of an unpleasant smell.
Well, it could be very useful, but you know, in areas with smog, in areas where people are worried about a COVID infection, this could be nice for some people.
How does it differ from, say, your standard mask that you'd pick up at the chemist or something?
Well, standard mask, standard fabric mask is just literally a three-layered device. It's got a strap on it so you can put it on your head and wear it normally. It needs to be cleaned quite often. You know, these devices, they're electric powered. They've got a battery in them. They can have fans so that the fan blowers can run on your face and you don't have to do as much heavy inhaling like you would with a fabric mask. It also has double HEPA filtration as well, so you've got a different type of filter rather than just a standard old layer of fabric. Apparently, the case has a UV lighting system to be able to clean the mask so that you're not needing to go through excessive processes to make sure you've cleaned it up for use every time as well. So, you know, these sort of masks have kind of already been around. They've been using them in areas where there is, you know, high smog content in the air to, you know, make things a lot more comfortable. But people are looking at mask technologies in all forms and looking to cash in on mask technologies thanks to COVID-19. And, you know, given it's a hot topic, it's a hot thing at IFA. Aside from that,
yeah.
though... IFA is the usual place where you see new mobile phone launches. Not so much this year because a lot of the manufacturers had already done their releases, but we did see some new manufacturers to the mobile phone scene. We've seen new laptops. Huawei's found themselves in releasing a brand new laptop product under the Honor brand. It's aimed at the users who would appreciate the quality aspects of a MacBook Pro, but maybe not the Mac operating system so much. In that sort of Pro range, there was cameras, smart speakers.
Does it use Windows then?
Yes, Windows.
Like, okay.
Definitely
is it banned
Windows
in America?
Well, products from Honor currently haven't been banned and currently aren't under the same stipulations as the main Huawei products. Who knows how long
are they? Are they cheaper than the Apple equivalent? I imagine so, right?
Yes, yes. Pricing is a lot better than the Apple equivalent, of course. You haven't got those overheads that you do with a Mac. I mean, you know, if you're crafty enough, you could potentially put Mac on it. People have done that before on Windows laptops, but... you know, there's those of us who don't really overly appreciate the Mac operating system. But yeah, a few things going on with the IFA events and new products launched. Not really that spectacular in a general sense. I mean, it's all of the usual sort of products. And I think, its interest has been watered down, unfortunately, due to the nature of COVID and, you know, people in different time zones and whatnot, different place, different time for something like this in 2020.
Well, there you go. Do you know what? Speaking of different times and, you know, you're touching on COVID and things like this, and one area that, or one segment of the population that has found this a little bit more harder to deal with than others has been kind of the aging population, the elderly, maybe those in aged care.
Yes.
Homes,
yes,
well, indeed. Being quite isolated from family and friends, and just in general, it can be a little bit lonely being in those types of facilities. So some geniuses have, as always, come to the table with a great idea. It's like, you don't need family. You don't have to keep bothering family to come visit you or sending them messages or calling them or FaceTime or video. Don't bother your family. Don't worry about making friends. We'll send you a robot to keep you company.
I don't think it's quite like that, but...
So, no, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but maybe those that don't have friends or family, they don't have anyone else to talk to. Now, robots are to be used in UK care homes to help reduce loneliness. So these robots can hold simple conversations and apparently learn from people's interests over time and maybe, you know, gesture and say hello. And then you can apparently talk to this robot and not feel so lonely.
Well, you know, that's a perfect in-betweener. It's a perfect in-betweener because, I mean, in care homes, you're in a situation where, you know, there's a certain number of workers, there's quite a number of people who live in the homes, and there'd be periods where they don't have interactivity. And I suppose if you brought in a robot in this form, as in it tends to bring itself into the situation and can interact with someone and you know, have basic conversations and share common interests in some form, like the whole playing music example, you know, it would be a good gap in the day.
Can you just put like a Google Home in something, and they could just talk to a Google or Alexa?
You can almost get that in some of the smart devices. So really, you know, it's kind of playing on that, isn't it?
Yeah, and I don't think, I mean, is it? So I think the weird thing is like the robots they have are really weird and awkward looking, but there are movies made about this, right, where people fall in love. What was that movie that was recent? It had like Joaquin Phoenix in it, and I think it was Scarlett Johansson was the voice of the thing. I think it was like Her. And essentially, she was like a robot, and then the guy like fell in love with the AI, because it was so personalized, and he could talk to her about anything, and she was like the perfect partner. So I mean, and there are, I swear there are other movies like that. And,
there probably is, but
I think the key is making it like the experience very lifelike and real, and yeah, like using AI and develop a personality. And then I totally see you could totally become quite attached to these AI beings, not just like robots.
Well, maybe, but I don't think the technology is developed enough just yet. You know, the fact that technology needs someone to program it, and, you know, the human mind as it stands to program these tools have not reached that point. But,
you'd use AI, right? And then a Neuralink, and it would just self-learn using...
It's getting there. I've got to say, it's getting there. You look at what you can do with, you know, smart devices, the smart speakers, or even just, you know, your mobile phone itself, and you can do a little bit with it right now. But it doesn't have that bond you have with a one-on-one conversation with another human being. But it's a start. And you've got to start somewhere, don't you?
I think when I get a little bit older, I'd probably want a different kind of robot, if you know what I mean. The ones they probably wouldn't allow me to have in an aged care facility.
Like the kind of things they've been showing off at IFA as well.
I'd be pulling it out from maybe under my bed and putting it away when the
pulling it out, visit. Hey?
anyway.
Terrible.
What else have you got going on?
Another thing that's been terrible, I've got to say, is the amount of hacking activity that's going on and not getting detected well enough as well. And to have it happen with a government agency is not too impressive. This one has been doing the rounds today, actually, at the time of recording this podcast. The government agency in New South Wales, Service New South Wales, has found themselves in a situation where they've been hit by what they're calling an email compromise attack. So they've had some users in their user base receive emails that were probably illegitimate, and the hackers have been able to take advantage of their credentials to get access to company records and pull out some data. They say the count for users that were affected was over 40, and they managed to pull out a sizable amount of data in this particular hacking attempt as well. It was something in the range of 738 gigabytes of data out of the Service New South Wales network, which, given that they're the people that administer driver's licenses, road registrations, fishing licenses, grants in some cases as well, it's a sizable thing. And it's really surprising that the organisation did not note the kind of traffic that would have been going out on their networks or through their virtual servers at the time of, you know, this sort of stuff happening. They reckon it's potentially affected 186,000 New South Wales customers, which is a sizable number. And those customers are being informed by a registered letter in the mail. You can't trust email at the point where email becomes the conversation about how the system was breached. They do say it's in the hands of the police at this point as a cyber attack. 738 gigs of data across their equipment. Would you not see that happening?
You'd think really? That'd be just a giant spike in traffic and bandwidth that it would raise some sort of alarm and flag. The whole thing's very weird, but then it is kind of government. I mean, they tend to be a bit, you know, not, they don't run the latest up-to-date software.
And yeah, maybe they're just not monitoring things well enough. You would have seen.
I think they will be now.
Oh, yeah. They've got to up their sort of cybersecurity plans now. I mean, you know, if you didn't see traffic over your network, you would see adjustments to records. You'd see something. And wouldn't you think if you had over 40 users in your network have issues with being compromised through an email method, you'd note that as well. I worked for a large organization at one point, and every time an illegitimate email went out due to the fact that a user's account had been compromised, it didn't take all that long before the ICT department would get onto it, notify all the users of what was going on, and shut down that person's user account temporarily while they worked out how to get rid of whatever was there causing the problem, so that it didn't exacerbate problems and become a real big headache for what they were doing day to day. And they did a reasonably good job at shutting these things down, and they didn't happen all that often after a period of time as well. So it kind of makes me think, well, where did it go wrong? Really?
Bureaucracy and processes and paperwork and licensing for a certain product over X amount of years. It's pure red tape that holds those sort of, you know, government departments and those big organizations back. I mean, the same thing, you know, for lots of even small to medium businesses would probably have better security than that. And I know in medium to large organizations generally have multiple layers of protection. I know there was one that we saw recently called, I think it's called Mimecast or something like that, which is when any email that comes in that has a link, your device needs to be pre-registered before you can even click that link. You get that sent an auth, like a verification code, then yep. You have to enter that through that, then your device is registered, and then whenever you click the link, it'll run it against any known bad links, and then it'll also let you know that this person has clicked this link. So if you did get breached, you could go back and find out how you got breached and block it off immediately. And then there's also, like, if you're using any sort of network or VPN or, you know, company piece of hardware, it generally, there'll be no software on there that will be allowed to run unless it was whitelisted or pre-approved beforehand. Yeah. And then if you any unwanted software is run, it blocks it, and then it'll tell you to, you know, call your IT department and then get that verified. So yeah, and especially now that we are in the situation we are, with way more people working at home now and working remotely, but still needing to, you know, access VPNs, yeah, or, you know, people getting sent more emails and links to file sharing things just to get things across from one person's home to another. Secure, like, now is the biggest time for, you know, malicious software to come into play, for hackers to try and steal people's data. There are so many more targets now, and I think it's very important in the current landscape that we are, everyone working remotely, that we do have to be extra careful, vigilant, knowledgeable. You know, all small to medium businesses need to be running at least some basic, you know, education around, you know, not clicking weird links or checking that the email address, if the email looks a bit funny, to check who the sender was and all this sort of stuff. This is the world we live in now, and as we do more and more sort of stuff remotely and access all these, you know, services, I think we really need to be a lot more vigilant moving forward. And stuff like this is a big wake-up call for those departments, and I think people don't really realize how big of an issue it is until they get breached or attacked, and then they take action. But you really got to be proactive. But try convincing, like, the mom and pop, you know, run business down the road to upgrade their IT security when they're just trying to sell some shoes online. It's a bit hard.
Even the process of them selling shoes online would have been a big challenge to get to. So, but, you know, it really reinforces that idea that if you don't have all that much of a clue of this sort of thing, it's worthwhile for you to spend the money, even if it's only for a couple of visits, to get someone who has the expertise to give you the right direction to steer in so that you don't become the next risk to security of people's information when you're doing some sort of online transactions.
Speaking of online transactions, happening more and more as we are at home, and tell me, have you ever ordered anything from Amazon?
Yes, indeed I have. I have an Amazon Prime membership. It doesn't get used to its full prime either, unfortunately. Yeah. But I do utilize it.
Yeah, so I think nearly everyone's at least heard of it, and then most people have probably ordered something off Amazon at some point in their lives. But recently, Amazon have taken down a five-star fraud in the UK. So it was a bunch of people that were top reviewers, and we all know this happens. We all know that essentially being paid to leave five-star reviews for things and inflating the 95% positive five stars or 4.7 stars, 800 reviews, whatever. You know, how much do you invest in a good review before you purchase a product? Are you the type of person that this is the product I want, and then you scroll down to the reviews and see what people say, or do you ignore that because you've done the product research beforehand?
I will do a lot of product research before, and I'll also look at a few different review sites, because this is the very reason why I can't trust a review on a platform where I might be buying it. Given we're in Australia, I'll go on to productreview.com.au, which seems to be a reasonable database of people, varying groups of users. I've already researched what I'm looking for anyway, so, I do look before I jump.
Yeah, but a lot of people don't. They kind of look around for products and they'll scroll down the reviews.
And just buy.
And it's really good sort of social proof. And this product's really good quality, good build, whatever, five stars, good things. In May, 58% of products on Amazon in the UK seem to have had fake reviews. 58%.
It's a staggering number. That's, 58 is well over half of them.
And some of these people, they looked at someone's account who's reviewing it, and it'll be a review every few hours across all these random products. And a lot of them are from China. So what they'll essentially do is they'll agree on a price for the review, then they'll send you the product for free, and then you can be a verified reviewer. You might even take pictures, whatever. And then, you might buy the product, they send it to you, then you do your whole review and leave it, even if it's crap quality, whatever, you just say it's amazing, you don't even look at it, then you ship it back to them and then they issue you a refund. So you're not actually paying for the product, you're just getting it to get the verified review thing or to show you've actually had the product to give your review more weight. They'll pay you for that positive review regardless of anything, and then you send it back so you don't pay for the product itself. And so I think there is quite a big market out there for these fake reviews, and they've been around for ages, but I think maybe because we're all at home now and people have more time to look into this sort of stuff and take action. But yeah, that's a staggering number. I always knew it happened, but I didn't realize it was that high of a percent. Now, if that's in the UK, I think it's safe to say it would be similar-ish numbers in US and also Australia. Why not?
Well, you would be thinking that, and you wouldn't be surprised if you did hear that was the case. But mind-boggling that sort of stuff can happen to that scale.
I think next time you look at a product online, and not just Amazon, this can happen
everywhere.
On any platform that you can leave reviews or a star rating. I think it's very important that you always take reviews with a grain of salt. Don't let them be the only reason you buy the product. Do your product research independently of the website you're buying it from. So don't just rely on Amazon or eBay or some random other shop. Get a ton of different opinions. Maybe actually look up a YouTube review of someone who actually had the product, or a blog that had the product and, shows them all the, do lots of independent research and then combine all that, then purchase the product. So I'll be definitely a little bit more vigilant when I you know, next time something's like 4.8 stars, I'll be like, is it? Is it really?
Is it, or are you just pumping up your tires? Which they could be doing. I wish the NBN would finish pumping up their tires. They pump up their tires and say they're done with.
Aren't they done already? Aren't they finished
building their network?
Is the rollout done?
No. Well, yes. Yes, but no, if you know what I mean. They have 126,000 or more fiber to the node premises that still can't reach the mandated speeds, which is minimum 25 megabits, which isn't that fast.
That's a download.
Yes, that's download speeds.
Do you have NBN at your place?
Yes. I'm in the country. We are on a fixed wireless service, which means we have a tower a few Ks away from us. We have a little dish on our roof. Well, it's not a dish. It's more like a panel. And that panel's connected back to the tower. You know, our download speeds are not too bad. I think we usually get between about 56 megabits, and it might go up as far as about 67 on occasions. So download is good. Upload is another story. We suffer from an unfortunate thing where the government decided that more people download than upload. So therefore, they made adjustments to what they were doing. So when we signed up originally, we were on 18 megabits upload. Now we get between 3 and 6 megabits if we're having a
that's
good
very
time.
Significant. And it's so ironic too, like the whole NBN thing, and when they were planning it out, it's like, oh, God forbid we actually rely on this network to run our economy. And now global pandemic and everyone's working from home needing to utilize both download and upload. And yeah, over 100,000 people still not even meeting the minimum, probably countless people having connections issues, dropouts, even though they're connected to the NBN, you know, issues to the node or a dodgy install. Yep. And just the limitations also of doing like the fiber to the node instead of fiber to the curb or the house, which is just a giant mistake. And really, imagine if every house had fiber to the curb at least, or every house had fiber directly to the house. If that was the infrastructure, we would be in a really good place now to operate our entire country remotely. And God, I hope in the next election, like, you know, they really have a go at the other side for not putting that into play and really showing.
There's got to be change. It's down part. Well, it's in part down to the government of the current era and the ideas they had in being able to cost save, which hasn't quite worked out, and the ability to allow the government to have a fair old say in what goes on, even though, you know, they have their own boards and they have their own functions. You don't only have to think about the fact that, you know, people are working at home during this COVID era. When you look at the situation for those of us rural customers who are on a fixed wireless service, you know, some of these people have always been working at home because they're on properties, they're farmers, and to have your upload cut in half means that it takes longer sometimes for you to get your job done. There are people that I know who work in even more remote places that use satellite internet connectivity to conduct their day job because they might live out in the Dust Bowl in the middle of Central Australia. And you know, while we can't put a fibre in that location, we should be able to provide an adequate satellite service. Another thing I've noticed from, you know, what I've looked at so far about minimum speeds and guarantees and requirements, they get away with the one thing that could let the whole situation down with reporting slow connectivity. You only have to reach that minimum speed at least once a day. And that could be at any stage of the day or night. So you could find yourself in a situation where your connection goes, you know, topsy-turvy across the peak of the day between 9 and 5, and it works fine in the evening. That'll be fine with NBN because you'll be reaching the minimum speeds.
Yeah, that's a bit ridiculous. I didn't know that was the case. I thought it would be consistently reaching it over a set amount of time. Wait, is that like once a day?
Yes.
Once a day you have to be hitting it? So what if you like hit it one day, then miss, hit it, miss?
That would be attributable to a network fault. They would accept that. But if you had a situation where you reached the peak minimum speeds at least once a day. So if, say you got up and had a coffee at 6 o'clock in the morning and speeds were good then they went to shit later on in the day, and that happened every day, you wouldn't necessarily have a basis where the NBN would want to investigate a fault for what it is. Your internet service provider might be a little bit more lenient on the situation. Like I find myself with Aussie Broadband, and they're actually really good with handling complaints where they can. But it is that situation, you know. If it reaches the peak speed once a day, everything's all right. When it's not.
Do they have any minimums for upload, or is it only download?
So upload is about 5 megabit. So
like a minimum requirement?
That's a minimum requirement. So in the case of our fixed wireless, when we get speeds of 3 to 6 or so, we can usually reach 5 at some point in the day, and that would be satisfactory. And currently, as far as I can tell with fixed wireless, based on all the conversations I've had with people who have been investigating why they can't get the full 10 megabit or even to the theoretical maximum, which would be about 9, they've said that investigations have been done, people have swapped antennas, and basically no one has a full idea about what's gone on when they've been trying to reprioritize their fixed wireless network. But yeah, there's still a number of customers, regardless of the technology, that find themselves in a situation where it's not what they thought it was. And, you know, some of those customers would really be regretting switching from ADSL, which in some cases, in some areas, actually worked quite well before all this come about.
Yeah, in some areas. Yeah, you're right.
Some areas.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when I was more regional before I moved to Melbourne, the regional area that I was living in previously actually had NBN and all set up ready to go. And I was living maybe 20 minutes from the Melbourne CBD, and I had to wait another year after I'd had it already in regional to then have it set up in Metro Melbourne, which just blew my mind. Like, surely they would develop the infrastructure in the cities first and then build out to the regional areas. But
well,
I guess there was no rhyme or reason, or maybe they thought, we could probably get jobs done quicker in regional.
That's the thing.
Because there's less complication, less houses maybe, and it will look better on our numbers. But to me, it was like I was going from a regional town to like Melbourne, and I was going from NBN to ADSL with 0.8 megabits down. I mean, up, sorry. Mm. And like maybe 8 megabits down, then 0.8 up. And I just couldn't do any work. It was that, and I had to wait a year to get it.
Less concrete, less tar, less NIMBYs complaining about where they're going to put things as well, I think comes down to a lot of the factors, especially did in the case of where they've put towers for these fixed services. I know there's areas where people rejected it because they thought it might be a blight on how everything looks around the place, forgetting the fact that they might have better internet connectivity if it does get put up. But, you know, they did a lot of regional rollouts and they did them pretty fast. The areas that we have lived around in the past, you know, the rollouts when they did happen within about a year or two, and you know, most people got some sort of connectivity. So, and you know, they're reaching what they call the end, but really it probably isn't the end. A little bit to do to fix up where it's not working as well as it should. As long as they keep looking at it, that'll be a good thing for all.
I think it's going to be one of those things that just go on forever and ever, really. The next thing would be like, oh, we decided to upgrade to fiber to the curb now. But then it'll be, you know, another 5 to 10 years of us complaining about, oh, we haven't got the fiber yet. Isn't the rollout of the fiber terrible? It's going to be an ongoing delay. Maybe we'll get there one day, or maybe we should just move to a, like, you know, one of those European countries that have huge download and upload speeds for, you know, $10 a month or something like that. And just
I tell you where is a where pretty been. Good place. The UK and even rural UK, where the governments and the telecommunications providers have failed, they've allowed the common man to get their cooperative together and roll their own cable. So that's quite neat. And you can do it. But we're stuck by regulations here in Australia.
Yeah, maybe that's a good idea, actually. Maybe I should just roll out some cable from the node and just wind it out back to my house and plug it straight into my computer.
It might look like some of the installations we've seen.
Put up some witch's hats so cars don't roll over the cable.
Roll it up through a tree. Bit of
conduit. Yeah, actually, that's not a bad idea. Go through the sky. Oh, well, we'll see what happens, I guess. Ever since we started this podcast, we've been talking or touched upon Uber.
We did. We have. Always, you did last week ongoing, as well, didn't we?
Yeah, it's an on. Did we already talk last week about Uber?
Well, yeah. Last episode we did.
What was it? Can you remember?
I can't quite remember.
I can't remember either. But it seems like we always are talking about Uber.
Uber likes that.
That's good, yeah, because and I think we said this years ago. They're always innovating, coming up with new things, or they're in the headlines for either good or bad. I remember ages ago we talked about Uber Boat. I wonder whatever happened to Uber Boat. That was a fun idea.
It's sunk.
Yeah. We need some crickets or something, sound effect. And then there was the other thing was the Uber. Uber Sky or something, Uber Chopper, Uber Helicopters, where that you could fly to work in a electric helicopter or the airport or something like that. So I wonder what happened to those trials that were happening around Melbourne or whatever. The new thing, and you mentioned the UK earlier, so this is another thing that's actually happening in the UK, is Uber's announcing that you'll be able to rent cars in the UK through their app, through a partnership with Car Trawler over there. And the interesting thing that I saw here is that the UK launch follows trials in France and Australia.
So where was it happening in Australia?
Yeah, I don't recall any trials about an Uber app where you could rent a car through the Uber. Maybe it was like in some random town, population of 3 people, and they just put the car there, released the app, called it a day. Yep, good enough to roll in the UK. And now they're releasing it in the UK. So, like, yeah, I didn't remember seeing anything in the news about you being able to rent a car through the Uber app. So I might look into that earlier. And I mean, if you're listening to this, you're familiar with the news story, feel free to send it over to us.
They're a little bit slow in Australia, though. There's already services out there. One of the biggest ones that I'm aware of is called GoGet. But also there's a website, Car Next Door, as well.
Yeah.
And these all work on the premises of, the premise of people signing up. You know, they might have to pay a fee to be able to access the service, but then they're given a way in which to authenticate with each of the vehicles that they go to. And you can essentially just, you know, make a booking for a vehicle, rock up, be able to get access to the vehicle, go and do your drive, and all you need to do is make sure you've topped the fuel up and, you know, you've left it in a clean and tidy manner and put it in an appropriate car park, which is designated for the vehicles. And, you know, everyone can share the cars anywhere. It works quite nicely.
Yeah, and I imagine that the way they'd probably do it is partner with what GoGet or Car Next Door, right? So, but then they just allow you to have it in the Uber app. So you could go rent a car and then it would use the whole Car Next Door back end or just take you to Car Next Door. But why would they do that when they already have an app? But I imagine, but the way it works may be similar using the network and the access and the infrastructure already in place by one of those car sharing platforms, but that's really interesting. Maybe like if you're an Uber driver and you've got your car that you normally Uber drive around in every day, but then you want to take the weekend off, right? I don't want to drive around the weekend. Maybe you can just set that car up that you would have driven Uber passengers in and set it as a rental, and then it pops up on the thing, and then anyone in the area, if they just need to rent a car for the day, they can rent that car that you otherwise would have been driving, but now you can relax.
Yeah.
And you can still get some income by someone else driving that car.
Be very neat.
Have you used any of those services, the GoGet or CarNextDoor?
I had a membership to GoGet. I was fortunate enough to be in one of the initial user base, although I didn't get to use it for long.
I guess more people in the metro areas that, you know, wouldn't have a car because they use public transport. And then my situation was I've used it a few times, CarNextDoor, and it was mostly when I've been moving house or helping someone else move.
You could rent a van.
A van, exactly right, to transport, you know, fridge, washing machine, bed, mattress, and then we just, you know, chucked it all in the van and transported it. And I mean, you can get some really good value. Like you can find vans for $10 an hour, $15 an hour. And generally you can do, you know, most of that stuff in one trip. So you're paying like maybe $23 and you've moved like all the big items in your house. And then, yeah, you just park your car and put the keys in the thing and take some photos. It's been a quite a seamless process. The annoying thing for me has been where people or the car isn't parked where it says it is on that app, or I think one time I opened up the key box and then the keys weren't in there. So I had to it was a whole process. And and in the app you set like the exact time window that you want to rent it as well. So I'd rocked up, I've undone the thing, looked for the key, it's not there. Meanwhile, the time's ticking along. So then I called the owner of the car up. I said, "Oh, hey, where's the key?" And he's like, "Oh, I took it out I was going to clean the car or something, but then like it was still available on the app." And he's like, "Oh, I'm 10 minutes away. I'll come around and drive you and give you the keys." And meanwhile, I'm just standing around on the curb waiting for this guy to come around and give me the keys to the van. And my time's ticking over. So I tried to call them up and say, "Look, this is what happened. Can you please extend my time without charging me?" And other times, like, I'll get into the car or the van. It sounds like I do it all the time. Not really. It's been three or four times. But you're meant to fill it up to, like, a quarter tank of fuel. And I'd get in, it would be under a quarter of a tank. Oh. So then I'd have to go fill the car up before we even start the journey.
Yes.
And then I have to call them up and say, "Look, it was under a quarter tank. I put in all this extra fuel." And then they have to reimburse you. And then it's a lot easier if you just have a mate with a van, but if you don't, it's not a bad service. But I mean, I wonder if Uber's going to have all these teething problems and how seamless the integration will be and how easily the bookings will be and access to the car and the price and all that sort of stuff. So that'll be interesting. And what I also find interesting is that they had trials in Australia, but then decided not to roll it out.
Well, it says something, don't you think?
Well, I think probably because the market's very saturated with like GoGet and CarNextDoor, that if they rolled out competition, maybe no one would go through Uber and it's just not worth their time, whatever. But here we are, another podcast talking about Uber, and I'm sure it's not going to be the last.
I could definitely see the smarts in someone like Uber releasing a service like this, because I know when I originally had an account with GoGet, I had a physical card, a bit like the good old MyKey. Of course, I've got one of those in front of me right now. So, you know, your physical hard plastic card with your NFC chip in it, and you could put that against the vehicle somewhere and that would authenticate you so you could get in and do your things.
That's cool. That's a way better idea than having the actual keys in some lockbox and add all that.
Then you're storing the keys in the actual device, the car, and you're just using the card to authenticate. And being, you know, Uber would have been an app, so you could use your phone, your NFC on your phone. Same sort of idea. Much more effective than CarNextDoor with the whole find a lockbox and get the keys and all that sort of ho-hum. But, They might do it. They might not do it. They might just leave it for GoGet and those guys to keep doing.
Yeah, we'll see how it goes, and we can do some further research on, you know, all the nitty gritty. But that's Uber for you.
It is.
And I think those are generally the big headlines that have come across us this week. And, you know, it's not every headline that we can delve deep into and flesh out and really unpack. Sometimes there are these tech headlines that come out and the news story is in the headline itself.
Yes.
And it's a little segment we call Quick Headlines. And we don't have a theme song, we extracted some audio from many a podcast ago, which we'll do for the theme song now and could do a bit of work. So Getty's play the theme song.
It was a little bit of a draft way back when.
These are the quick headlines. These are the quick technology headlines of the week. Getty's, give me some quick headlines.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, you know, having listened to that now, I don't think it does need any more work. I think that is cream of the crop.
You reckon that's beautiful?
Polished. Produced high quality audio radio production value.
It was recorded in a studio, I recall that much.
We need not do any more to it. Do you remember last quick headlines we talked about the Twitter quotes feature? Well, Twitter quote tweets are now easier to find, and Twitter are officially rolling out this new quotes tweet counter, which lets you easily see every time a given tweet has been retweeted with a comment. So it's rolling out, is essentially in all that words that I said.
I don't think I've. Oh, yes,
maybe you don't
I
have it yet.
Seen it.
Do you?
I have.
Oh, you have seen it. I don't know if we don't have it on our Twitter account at TechRap Australia. Follow us along on Twitter if you are listening.
So this is on screen, that is. I've got a tweet from Tony Tardio, and it says 7 quote tweets.
Well, there you go. And I assume you can just tap that, and then it will bring you to ones that have all had the conversation.
Yep.
But I wonder if that'll narrow it down then to conversation to, like, less retweeters, right? Before you could have, like, conversation running, maybe people would just want to jump onto that thread. But we'll see how it goes.
It does on the mobile phone. It's gone into only the conversations that people have quoted. So, it's not working very well. But anyway,
we'll make sure when we put this out on Twitter, you can quote our tweet.
It's got to be a bit memorable.
Okay, Human Forest.
They're a brand.
They're a company. It's not an actual forest full of humans. They got 2.3 million from Cabify founders and others to grow a free e-bike sharing service in the UK, London. So you wonder how it's free. Apparently there's going to be advertising on the bikes or displayed to you. So you're riding essentially billboards around, but for free.
Nice. So well, good luck to them. Unfortunately, the whole e-bike and scooter thing hasn't worked here in Australia because we've got too many idiots, too many village idiots.
Yeah, well, there you go. Teamico, a Stockholm-based startup, wants to reproduce office interactions in a virtual environment.
How do they propose this manner?
Well, they want to foster spontaneous interactions and casual collaboration with a room-based interface where you can move from one room to another. Say, like, I'm going to go hang out with Getty's by the water cooler room.
Mm.
And then we can chat about sports or whatever people talk about. Or let's go to the boardroom and see what's going on there. Let's, you know, so it's essentially just like channels that you can go chat with your teammates.
I mean, I am envisaging something a little bit like something that I have operated before. I can't remember the name of it for the life of me, but essentially it was a website and you had a bobblehead and you could put the picture in the background of whatever you wanted. So you could have like a little map of different rooms that you could go to and you could move your head back and forward between people that were scattered around the room, and you would only hear the conversation or conversations closest to where you are. So it was essentially a bit like being in a room. So you could move around the room and have the conversations. And you could also add extra things, like you could add a YouTube video or you could stream something and you could just pop these little objects in and it could be part of the room to give you some sort of you're in a room, you're with people kind of activity.
Yeah, but like you don't really want to do that with your workmates. Generally, half the time you spend in an office is avoiding talking to people because you don't like them. You don't want to actively go into the water cooler room with a bunch of people and Greg from accounts that you don't want to talk with because he's so boring. He's just going to talk about his two-year-old child, how it kept him up all night and he did the diarrhea nappies. Like, I'm not relating to that. That's not interesting, Greg.
No,
stop talking about your child. So, like, and we've trialed things that are work to try and foster these spontaneous casual interactions and they just never work. It's like, it's not the same. It's forced interactions. It's not casual and spontaneous because it is prearranged. Part of the casual interactions is the fact that you just bumped into someone and you just start a random conversation with them. But the point where you have to take time out of your day aside to then have this interaction and make an effort, that's where it all falls apart. So that's a disaster idea and it'll never work. But here's me saying that. And then 6 months later, they'll be like launching a $10 billion IPO or something. And then I'll be eating my hat.
But will you be eating your hat though?
I'll be eating my beanie.
I'll keep it in mind. I'll make a note.
This is a good one. Facebook Watch is getting 1.25 billion visitors each
month. Facebook Watch?
So maybe we should start streaming on Facebook Watch, or is that, I think that's just like, you know, any video that you play on Facebook in that new Watch tab, right, that they're trying to promote in the middle there with the new interface. It's like a TV.
Yep. Lots of
people are watching it.
You
apparently.
Can watch on your Apple TV devices as well. They've got a dedicated app.
Maybe we
should
upload the podcast there, the video. People can watch us on Facebook.
Well, we could give it a try. Definitely give it a try.
Here's one for you. SpaceX confirms Starlink internet private beta underway, showing low latency and speeds over 100 megabits per second.
I did hear this one. This one could be a serious challenge to the NBN in some areas of the country. And from the conversations that have been had online between different users that find themselves in different areas in Australia, they reckon the reliability. I mean, you know, you've got different orbits and stuff going on, and different times at where people can access things in the sky and see things in the sky from here in Australia. But we have a really good peak time so far to access those particular satellites. So it could really pay off to those people who find themselves in a situation where they're on a current satellite service or on SkyMuster. It's not always great for them. This could be their next big ticket to getting faster internet.
Yeah, well, the beta is currently available to SpaceX employees only at the moment, but they're going to be rolling out a public
beta. They are doing a public beta,
I guess. So, Geddes, I'd highly recommend you jumping over to the website and putting your interest in to be a part of that.
I may be already signed up.
Oh, hey, there we go. Keep it. Let us know if you're successful and how that goes.
Apparently, you're not allowed to talk about it, though.
Oh, really? Like an NDA? You have to sign off an NDA sort of thing?
From what I've seen, there is some sort of NDA in relation to, I mean, you could probably tell people you're on it, but you can't tell people how fast your connections are.
Yeah, we'll have to maybe have a private conversation about it, but not on the podcast, at least immediately.
Under the table.
And here is the last quick headline for the week, and one that I'm in two minds about this because I'm a bit of a hoarder.
I won't show anyone the setup here.
Firefox 81 for Android gets an automatic tab closing option. So when I say hoarder, I'm the type of person that has 20 tabs open in their browser across multiple like windows. So I'll have two instances of the browser and I'll have about like 15 to 20 tabs and I don't want to close them because they're important information and just in case I need it later.
So
is
like
80 tabs, is it? 89? 98.
98.
It's backwards on the camera, but 98 tabs. There you go. So both on PC and on my phone, I never close tabs. And I have currently two Chrome windows, both in private browsing. Sorry, if I close, I'll lose all my tabs. So two private browsing window instances up with about 15 tabs in each. So I don't actually shut down my computer at night because I don't want to lose yes. all my tabs. I put it to sleep. It's so bad. I have a problem and I acknowledge I have a problem with the amount of tabs I have open. And it needs to be addressed. And maybe if this feature is in the web browser of Firefox, I'll turn it on. But it looks like that's what we're talking about Android at the minute. But I assume it's a feature taken from the browser. Initially what it does is you'll set a time limit for the tabs, say like 1 day, 1 week, 1 month. And then if you haven't accessed that tab in, say, the 1 day or 1 week, it'll automatically close that tab because clearly if you haven't accessed it in a week or a month, you don't need that tab. And if you do, you can probably find it again. But I have a real hard trouble of like letting go of like, what if I need that tab later? Or
yes.
Or that, I'll go back to that later, or click, 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 click. I'll visit that one later, or I'll go do something else. And then I'll look at those other three. I'll look at those tomorrow. It's a problem. And it's probably one that'll take another hour of discussion to talk through and maybe some therapy.
You know,
but
yeah.
I think something like this is a good option.
Well, I've got this little niggle that says this feature won't work for you because having that mindset of wanting to keep things, you'll find ways around the feature.
Oh, so I'll just make sure I'm clicking all my tabs so that I
Because I may just have a little bit of a problem as well, and I know that I would do that. I have never been able to maintain keeping an inbox tidy. I've always had a number of unread messages, and people go, "How can you do that?" It's like, well, I look at all the messages which are important, and all the other ones sit there because I'm too busy doing other things. So you know. We get it. Some people don't. Yeah. We might leave it there.
Yeah, I think it's best we leave it there, and then that's pretty much it for the week.
Oh, that's another edition of Tech Wrap. we're getting into a bit of a groove here. I'm trying to feel comfortable with the idea of being filmed as well. It's a new thing for me.
Yeah, it's new. Normally you're on the radio behind. The
behind
microphone
a mic,
and not
like
in front
I am
of the
right
camera,
now.
But, you know, even in the radio world, you know, it's more heading that way, that it's more and more on screen stuff, and it's just the way of the future. People like to see the people that they're listening to.
I think I need a better environment, though.
Yeah, we both do. One, maybe once we're not doors. Stuck in confinement, we'll get into a studio.
Maybe. In the meantime, you can follow us, techwrap.net, TechWrap Australia on Facebook. We do
Twitter.
We're on email as well. If you want to send us any media releases or review requests or anything you like, actually, mail@techwrap.net is the email address. And you can find our podcast on all platforms, including Spotify as well. If you happen to be like me and you have Spotify running on your mobile phone and you have it running on your computer as well, you can do a nice little search and find Tech Wrap podcast, and all of the editions are there on your mobile phone. How sweet. You can take it with
you
on the go.
Subscribe and get notifications, I dare say, when a new episode comes out.
Yep, you can follow it. It's got a follow button as well on Spotify. So
there you go.
You can't miss us.
All right, Geddy's a pleasure as always, and we'll see you next week.
Until next week.